You're listening to the weekly teaching podcast of Beaverton Christian Church in Beaverton, Oregon. We hope that what you hear today inspires you to laugh, question, think, and grow. If you'd like to connect with us even further, hit us up online at beaverton.cc or shoot us a direct message on Instagram or Facebook. Thanks for listening, and we hope you enjoy this week's episode.
You know, one of the most phenomenal things that I've ever seen in my life happened in the summer of 1992 in the middle of the night, and I was sitting on the couch watching TV. I wasn't watching like some late night weird show. I was watching the Olympic Games from Barcelona, Spain that year. And my event, the event that I ran in high school, was coming up. And that was the 400 meters. And the 400 meters, I actually hated this event because it's terrible. It just kills you the whole time. They used to call it a run. They don't call it a run anymore. I mean, it pushes you physically to your limit. And so I was ready to watch it. And one of the runners in the race that day was named Derek Redmond, who was one of Great Britain's most prolific runners. But he was also familiar with injury. He had 13 operations on his knees and Achilles tendons. In fact, in 1998 in Seoul, Korea, he couldn't even enter his event because of an injury that he had. In the quarterfinals, he had had the best time in the Olympic Games so far, and he was lining up in the semifinals, and he was a favorite to win the gold medal. He took off in about 150 meters into the race. Everything was going well, but he says, in his own words, "I heard a loud popping sound." And then he felt the searing pain of any runner's nightmare, a pulled hamstring. And he just collapsed. His dreams of Olympic gold were over yet again. And the cameras and the crowd, they were watching all the runners go across the finish line. But then something caught their eye. And I stood up off the couch in the middle of the night in San Jose, California, where I was living. And I saw Derek Redmond hobbling his way around the track, still about 200 meters from the finish line. I saw the medical personnel, they came out and tried to help him, but he didn't want anything to do with them. The security wanted to get him off the track, but he kept on shrugging him off, and he was hobbling towards the finish line, and he was in agony. And then out of nowhere, this lone figure jumped out of the stands. And he ran up, dodging security because they wanted to get him off the track too. He ran up behind Derek and put his arm on him. At first, Derek says that he thought it was security again, but then he turned around and realized that he was looking into his father's eyes. And his dad said, "You know, you don't have to do this, son. It's okay." And Derek said, "Yes, I do," because he didn't go to the Olympics to not finish again. And then his dad said, "Well, if you're going to do it, let's do it together." And 65,000 people in the stadium that day stood on their feet and cheered. And millions around the world watched as father and son walked towards the finish line together. You know, Christian spirituality and the story that the scriptures are telling us, at their very essence, at their very core, it's a story of an amazing Father in heaven. But he doesn't stay in heaven. He steps out onto the track, into the race of our lives. And he comes to us and he embraces us, injury and all. And then he walks with us to the finish line and beyond. In a word, it's a story of grace. And grace says, "I want to be close to you." Grace says, no matter who you are, no matter what you look like, no matter where you've been, no matter where you're at today, I want to be close to you. And you know what? I want you to be close to me. I want to give you a close encounter. Jesus said it this way. When Jesus walked on the earth and he saw the crowds, it says that they were harassed and they were helpless. They were like sheep without a shepherd, and he had compassion on them. And he said to the crowds with his arms open wide, he says, "Come to me." all who are weary and carrying heavy loads, and I will give you rest. That comes from Matthew chapter 11, and he also talks about giving us a life. He calls it a yoke, but what he's talking about is giving us a life that perfectly fits us so that we can be the very best version of us that we can possibly imagine. And when he says he's going to do this, he says it's going to restore your soul. And isn't that what we need? Don't we need rest and restoration? Don't our communities and our nation, don't we need rest and restoration? Because you know what injuries like, right? I mean, it might not be a pulled hamstring, but maybe it's a broken marriage. Or maybe it's the wounds of the broken home that you grew up in and they're still with you today. Maybe there's something between you and one of your kiddos or one of your adult kiddos or one of your grandchildren. Or maybe for you, it's your finances. Or maybe you're in a dark tunnel today when it comes to your future. Maybe it was a call from the doctor and it wasn't good news. Or maybe it's your career and you've been working and working and working and you felt like you've done everything right, but the result has not been good. We all need the power of grace in our lives. In fact, that's God's solution for the problem of injury. And grace comes to us in lots of different ways, but one of the most beautiful ways is in close proximity. I love the scriptures, and I love, one of the things I love about it is that they're so messy and they're so complicated. You ever read the Bible and just think, that's messy and complicated, that story. I can't believe the twists and turns that are going on there. I mean, who would write something like this? If you're trying to draw people to follow, why would you say it this way? But you know why the scriptures are messy and complicated? It's because we're messy and complicated, right? I mean, you read about some of these Old Testament heroes that we have, these characters, and I know you've been looking at some of their lives, and I half expect to see one of them in the next Avengers movie, you know what I mean? Like Moses conquers the Red Sea water monster and saves the Sinai Peninsula. You know, you just expect to see that. And sometimes they seem out of reach, these characters, like you can't relate. But when I slow down, and I find myself in the text, and I try to see through the lenses of these humans that have gone before us, and I sit there for a while, and I become an actor in the grand story that God is writing, then I feel like I can start to relate a little bit to some of their highs and to some of their lows, and to some of the questions that they were asking, and I realize they're experiencing the human journey just like me. One of those characters that we're going to talk about today is Elijah, and Elijah is kind of a crazy character. I mean, he's messy and he's complicated, and he's on this sort of emotional roller coaster in his life. He's a prophet of God, and so he's supposed to speak to the people of God about what they need to hear, but oftentimes people don't want to hear it. And so Israel had a habit of killing their prophets off. And so this is not like a job you want to sign up for, but God calls him to be this spokesperson. And he lives in the 9th century BC, which was not a good time to live in ancient Israel. At one time, ancient Israel was the power of the world. The Davidic kingdom was strong, and they had the best military. They had the most riches, and they were sort of on top of their area of the world. And he passes the dynasty off to Solomon, and they get even richer and more powerful. And you would have thought at that time, if you were alive, that this is going to go on forever. But as with all cultures in history, at some point, things start to unravel. And their hearts start to grow cold. And their hearts start to wander away from their God who is called Yahweh. And then there's this crazy civil war, right? And so you have the northern kingdom in Israel, and there's Samaria in between, and then you have the southern kingdom of Judah, and it's just all shattered and split apart. I mean, God, what are you doing? And if you lived in northern Israel at the time, you would have been asking, are you really faithful, God? And maybe that's a question you're asking these days. Are you really faithful? You made this covenant, but I don't see you coming through with things. You look outside the window and it's chaos. And we're told all the way through the book of 1 Kings that there's one evil leader after another. And it just keeps getting worse all the way up until chapter 16 in 1 Kings. And it says that a man named Ahab came into power. And it says that he was more evil than everybody who came before him. So he is the worst of the worst. Not only that, he marries the evil queen Jezebel, who wasn't an Israelite in the first place, but she was also a priestess of the ancient deity known as Baal. And Baal was a god. He was one of many gods around the area that people worshiped. And he was a god that controlled the weather. So the thunder and the lightning and all these different things, the crops would grow because of Baal. And you would have babies because of Baal. And because he was this god of fertility, usually in the spring, but all year long, people would come and they would offer all sorts of crazy sacrifices saying, please, we need to have more babies and we need our crops to grow because this is national security stuff in the ancient world. If you don't have food in an agricultural world, you're in trouble. You're going to die off. If there's not rain, there's trouble. So you would sacrifice and pray for rain. And if you don't have babies, you don't have anybody to work the land and you don't have a military to protect you in ancient tribal warfare. And this is a chaotic, bloody period in human history. And so this is really, really important stuff. And she comes on the scene and she says, Baal's in charge of all this stuff. And slowly, the people of Israel started to turn their hearts away from Yahweh and towards Baal worship. The God who had loved them, the God who had rescued them, the God who had provided for them in the desert, and the God who gave them space in the world, now they were turning away from. And this is where Elijah comes on the scene. He's sort of this mystery man, and we don't really read about him before this, but he comes, and the first words out of his mouth are a declaration of war. They don't sound like it, but with our ancient lenses on, this is what he says. He says to Ahab, this evil leader, as the Lord, the God of Israel, lives, whom I serve, there will be neither dew nor rain in the next few years except at my word. Declaration of war. My God's bigger than your God. It's kind of like out on the playground when you're little kids. My dad's bigger than your dad. I mean, this is the way that people thought. And if there was a battle between two tribes, the losing tribe realized that the other God was stronger. Or they had just really disappointed their God, and so God, he wasn't going to protect them or help them out. It was this spiritual chaos that went on and on and on. And then Elijah does something really smart. He runs. He declares war and he's like, I'm out of here. And he runs and he spends some time in a ditch, in a ravine that was filled with water, and these birds came to feed him. But then the water dried up and then he went right into the belly of the beast, into enemy territory. And I mean, if you're going to hide from Ahab, who's looking for him, and Jezebel, who's looking for him, where are you going to go? I'm going to go right into enemy territory where Jezebel's father lived, because they're not going to find me there. And he lives with the widow and her son. And the days go by, and the days go by, and the days go by. And if you're Elijah, you might be wondering, where are you, God? I mean, you call me to say this, and what's going on? I'm just sitting here. I thought you had a plan for my life. And here I am in this situation. Is this how you treat your leaders, God? You feed them with birds, and I have to go hang out with this foreigner in this foreign land? I don't get it. But then the day comes where God says, go back and talk to King Ahab, because there's going to be a showdown. And this showdown wasn't against Elijah, and it wasn't, you know, between Elijah and Ahab or anything like that. This is a showdown in their minds between Yahweh and Baal. And we pick up the story in chapter 18 and verse 30. It says, Elijah said to all the people, "Come here to me." They came to him, and he repaired the altar of the Lord. And so let me pause right there. This is how the contest is going to work. This is how the battle is going to work. There's two altars. They build these two altars, and they make a deal. Whoever is able to call fire down from their God out of heaven, and their God burns up their sacrifice, that's the true God. That's the winner. And so they all agree to this. And there's about 850 prophets on one side, and there's Elijah on the other side. And these prophets on the side of Baal, they start to dance around, and they start to pray, and they start to cry out, and they even start to cut themselves with stones, and they're bleeding all over the place from morning until noon, but nothing happens. And at about noon, Elijah starts to... He starts to mock him a little bit. I mean, we get into the personality of Elijah here. He's like, well, maybe your God's busy. Maybe he's on the phone. Maybe he's in the bathroom. I mean, it's really weird stuff that you can read. It's like, hey, your God ain't showing up. And so this is when Elijah moves into action. It says in verse 31, he took 12 stones, one for each of the tribes descended from Jacob, to whom the word of the Lord had come. So he's connecting this with their past, with their story, with the covenant, saying, your name shall be Israel. With the stones, he built an altar in the name of the Lord, and he dug a trench around it large enough to hold two seahs of seed. He arranged the wood and cut the bowl into pieces and laid it on the wood. Then he said to them, fill four large jars with water and pour it on the offering and on the wood. I mean, what are you doing here, Elijah? This doesn't make sense. The people had to think, this guy's nuts. He's been living out in the wilderness for way too long. What's he talking about pouring water all over this? And then he says, do it again. And they did it again. Do it a third time, he ordered, and they did it a third time. The water ran down around the altar and even filled the trench. At the time of the sacrifice, the prophet Elijah stepped forward and he prayed, Lord, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, let it be known today that you are God in Israel and that I am your servant and have done all these things at your command. Answer me, Lord, answer me, so that these people will know that you are Lord, that you, Lord, are God, and that you are turning their hearts back again. Then the fire of the Lord fell and burned up the sacrifice, the wood, the stones, the soil, and also licked up the water in the trench. Verse 39 says, when all the people saw this, they fell prostrate and cried, the Lord, he is God. The Lord, he is God. And if that's not enough, we get a second miracle in the same chapter. In verse 45, it says, meanwhile, the sky grew black with clouds. The wind rose. A heavy rain started falling, and Ahab rode off towards Jezreel. And so the floodgates are open. And Ahab, with his tail between his legs, I think it actually says that in the Hebrew, his tail between his legs, he goes running back to his place of power on the throne, not knowing what to do. And then there's a third miracle. In fact, it's an 18-mile miracle for you marathoners in the room. Verse 46 says, the power of the Lord came on Elijah, and tucking his cloak into his belt, he ran ahead of Ahab all the way to Jezreel. Three miracles, one chapter. I mean, this is it. Elijah must have been on the highest of highs. I mean, Elijah's the kind of guy we want to follow on Instagram, right? I mean, what's going to happen next with this guy? Elijah's the kind of guy, man, we want to elect him to official office. We want him to take over as leader. I mean, look at that guy. And he goes back to the throne room to where Ahab and Jezebel sit on the throne and hang out. But that's not how the story goes, is it? That's not how life goes. Is it? Remember when I said the scriptures are messy and complicated because we're messy and complicated? Some of you can remember in the past some amazing thing that has happened in your life, like maybe a win that you had, or maybe a win that your kids had. Maybe it was like a spiritual connection with God that you had at one point in your life, this journey that you've been on. But maybe it's been a long time for you. And you've wondered, what have you done lately for me, God? I mean, I don't get this. I don't get this thing. I don't feel the same anymore. I don't necessarily have the same thoughts anymore. And I don't see you showing up so much anymore either, God. And we start to see and approach and ask the questions that we all ask as humans. We ask questions about the contradictions of life. Why me? Why this? Why now? Oh, come on, God, help me out here. And this is where we see Elijah's life going. In chapter 19, it says, "Now Ahab told Jezebel everything Elijah had done and how he had killed all the prophets with the sword." So Jezebel sent a messenger to Elijah to say, "May the gods deal with me, be it ever so severely, if by this time tomorrow I do not make your life like that of one of them." And then very simply in verse 3 of chapter 19, it says, Elijah was afraid and ran for his life, and wouldn't you? What are you doing, God? I don't get it. I mean, I thought that things were going to change. I thought if I walked in obedience to you, I thought if I did this, this, and this, that everything was going to be different. Man, I thought the scriptures were a to-do list. I thought it was a playbook for life, and I've been playing this playbook, and it's not working out for me. And then we realize, oh, wait a minute. Maybe life is messier than that, and maybe it's more beautiful than that, and maybe your story is more beautiful than that. Maybe that's not how the scriptures are supposed to work. Maybe it's not a punch list. Maybe it's a story that God's inviting us into as we find ourselves as one of the characters in his grand play. And so we see Elijah going from the high, high to the low, low. And I don't know when it happened for Elijah, but what we do know is that he finds himself under a bush, under a broom bush, and he wants to die. Like, I don't know when it happened for Elijah. I don't know if when he was living in that ditch with those ravens feeding him, I don't know if his heart just started to wander. I don't know if it was when Ahab sat on the throne and Queen Jezebel came into the picture. Maybe he was like, God, you're not really coming through. I don't really get this thing anymore. And so maybe he just started to drift a little bit. I don't know. He's rolling up his sleeves. He's doing everything that he can. He's given it his all. He's been faithful all the way through. But then there's this sense of maybe deep in his heart, he's just drifting a little bit. And you know what happens when we drift? When we drift long enough, it creates distance. And when there's enough distance for enough period of time, it creates disconnection. And if you're married and you're living in the same home with somebody where there's disconnection, you know that you can be in great proximity, close proximity, and yet have disconnection. If you have kids that have grown up and they're adults now and they never call you and you never call them, you know what it's like to have disconnection. If you had a friend that was your faithful friend and somehow there's been betrayal there, you know what disconnection is like. There's all sorts of things in life that cause us to drift. And then pretty soon, distance grows. And then pretty soon, we're looking at God and we're saying, where in the world are you today for me? And this is what's going on with the prophet Elijah. You see, maybe you had a close encounter with God at one point in your life. And you look back at it fondly. I mean, you remember it. It was a beautiful time. And that's awesome. We ought to celebrate those times. We ought to remember those times. We need to get out the old photo albums. I'm visiting my mom up here on vacation. She lives in Westland. And every time I come up, I look at the old photos. They're like the physical photos that are not online or Facebook. I can't see them any other way. I got to come up to Oregon and I see those photos. And I remember those times. Maybe for you in your journey with God, you have these fond memories. But the problem with the memories is they can't sustain us for the long haul. We celebrate them, we remember them, but they can't really sustain us because a close encounter is actually meant to be experienced more than it's meant to be remembered. Years ago, I started ultracycling, and so ultracycling is anything over 100 miles. I used to do 100 to 200, usually 150 to 200 is what I would train for, and then I did a lot of centuries and that sort of thing. And unfortunately, when I first started ultracycling, my ability to ride long distances outpaced my ability to know how to have nutrition on the bike. In other words, I was not a smart man. And so I would go on these long rides, and I would just sort of drink when I felt like drinking and eat whatever I wanted. And I was on a long training ride one time, about 65 miles. I was going from Folsom Lake all the way down to downtown Sacramento. And then I was on my way back. And about three-fourths of the way through, I realized that something was wrong with my body. It just wasn't working right. It started stiffening up. And I knew something was really bad with about 10 miles to go because these moms with their strollers were passing me like on a hill. I mean, it was bad. And so with about 7 miles left, it was dusk. It started to get dark. And I just knew I had to get to this gas station to get some liquids in me. But I wanted to rest. And so I stopped on the bike trail. I got off my bike and I laid flat on my back and I was looking up at the sky. And then I had this thought, this is how people die, you know? They're all by themselves. And so I struggled to get back on my bike. I made it to the gas station. I got a big old bottle of green Gatorade and I chugged it down. And it came up just as fast as it went down, much to the chagrin of everybody in the parking lot, believe you me, with 4 feet of projectile vomit hitting them. It was bad. And then I called my wife. She came and got me. I took a nap. I woke up. I ended up being okay, but that was the day I learned about nutrition on the bike. And I learned what to eat, when to eat, how to eat. I learned what to drink, when to drink, how to drink, and all of that stuff, and how much my body needs. You see, I could eat a big meal for breakfast before a ride, but 50 miles in, that food ain't doing me any good anymore. And in the spiritual life, there are these rhythms of grace that we can walk in that will sustain us for the long haul, even when we don't feel close to God, when we're longing for a close encounter, but it's not coming for us. The rhythms are when we make ourselves available to God through prayer. God makes himself available to us through the scriptures. Sometimes the rhythms of grace are just giving our life away, or maybe it's just silence and solitude. We leave the community so that when we come back, we can be a gift to the community. These are the things that sustain us. I don't know what the story was with Elijah, but what we do get is we get one of his lowest lows. It says he came to a broom bush and sat down under it and prayed that he might die. "I have had enough, Lord," he said. "Take my life. I am no better than my ancestors." Then he lay down under the bush and fell asleep. And you have to believe that he was in utter depression, utter disillusionment. Some people call it complete deconstruction. His life was unraveling and he was done. But God shows up in the most amazing and human way. Sometimes when we're at the bottom, we want God to like send fire down from heaven, right? We want a miracle. Come on, you got to come through for me. I want something big. I want a mountaintop experience. But that's not what Elijah gets. And so often, that's not what we get. But what he gets is this very normal human touch from God. Listen to how the story goes. All at once, an angel touched him and said, "Get up and eat." He looked around and there by his head was some bread baked over hot coals and a jar of water. Very, very simple. He ate and drank and lay down again. Verse 7 says, "The angel of the Lord came back a second time and touched him and said, 'Get up and eat, for the journey is too much for you.'" When I think about my journey, that's true for me. It's often too much for me. When I think about parenting, it's too much for me. When I think about the things that God has called me to in my career, it's too much for me. when I think about trying to hold marriage together and make it more beautiful during the ups and downs of life that things are thrown at you, not to mention my own brokenness, it's too much for me. See, there's this myth that we have sometimes about God. And the myth is that God will never give you more than you can handle. Actually, God's in the business of giving you more than you can handle. And it's at those times that we're most vulnerable, but it's at those times that we have the ability to experience a close encounter with God. You see, you can't manipulate a close encounter. You can't manufacture it. You can't force it, but you can anticipate it. You can be ready for it, and you can make space in your life for it. And I think that's what's happening here with Elijah. God puts him in a place where there is now space for this close encounter with him. So what has life been like for you lately? I find that sometimes God shows up in the most normal ways. He doesn't send fire from heaven. There's not a great miracle, but somebody hugs me at just the right time. I have a file at home. I have a physical file, like old school, and then I have a computer file called my encouragement file, because over 26 plus years of ministry, people have written me notes and letters at just the right time. And I'll pull one out every once in a while and go, oh, that's right. That's right. God's faithful. Okay. Yes, I remember that happened. That's fantastic. Sometimes it's somebody sitting and having coffee with you and hearing your story and not having any judgment on you whatsoever. Sometimes it's people offering to babysit your kiddos, like your small, crazy, rambunctious kiddos, and they offer to do it for free. Now that's a miracle. That's an act of God right there. So sometimes he does do miracles. But I believe that he shows up in the most human ways sometimes. And if our eyes are open, and if our hearts are moldable, we see the hand of God in our lives saying, I love you, come closer to me. Come to me, all who are weary and heavy burdened. And this is what's happening with Elijah. And so in verse 8, it says that he got up and he drank, and strengthened by that food, he traveled for 40 days and 40 nights, another miracle, and he reached Horeb, the mountain of God, which, by the way, is also Mount Sinai, the mountain that Moses stood on. And when he's at this mountain, he walks into a cave, and I don't know if it was a dark cave, but maybe he thought, okay, I'm here, whatever you want, God, and he collapses. And then it says about halfway through verse 11, then a great and powerful wind tore the mountains apart and shattered the rocks before the Lord, but the Lord was not in the wind. After the wind, there was an earthquake, but the Lord was not in the earthquake. After the earthquake came a fire, but the Lord was not in the fire. And after the fire came a gentle whisper. When Elijah heard it, he pulled his cloak over his face and went out and stood at the mouth of the cave. Then the voice said to him, what are you doing here, Elijah? It's a simple whisper, something that parents do with their babies. You whisper to your kids sometimes. It's a loving father with their child saying, I love you and I'm here. And if you read the verse between, Elijah's kind of unraveling a bit, and he's wandering in his thoughts, and he feels lonely, and like things aren't adding up, and God's not really being faithful. I love that. I love the honesty of the scriptures. I think that it makes them ring true. In fact, I have those times in my life. I do this sometimes in my car. I'm going down the highway. You know, I'm in my car by myself. Nobody can hear me. And I call it my dashboard confession time, where I just let God have it. I'm like, look, God, here's the deal. Boom, boom, boom. And look what happened. All right. So what's going on? And I'm just authentic. I'm vulnerable and I'm real. And I think that's what God longs for. He already knows what I'm thinking anyway. He knows what I'm feeling anyway. He's not surprised by any of it. He's like, just let it out, man. I'm big enough to handle all of your angst and your anger and your frustration and your disillusionment. I can take it all. And that's what Elijah does. And then in verse 15, it says, the Lord said to him, go back the way that you came. Go to the desert of Damascus. When you get there, anoint Hazael, king over Aram. anoint Jehu, king of Nimshi, king over a son of Nimshi, king over Israel, and anoint Elijah, son of Shaphat, from Abel-Malahoa to succeed you as prophet. You know what's going on there. It's not just a list of things to do, right? It's not a to-do list. What God is saying to Elijah is, I'm not done with you yet. Like, you may be done with me, and you may be done with you, but I'm not done with you. If you're not 6 feet under, God's not done with you yet. He's got a plan, and he's got a mission, and he wants a close relationship with you. He wants you to come closer. You know, the interesting thing about that story about Derek Redmond and that 400 meters back in 1992 is that before that race, him and his father, they were not close. In fact, they weren't even on speaking terms. But Derek went on to say that after that race, the relationship began to be repaired because of a 200-meter walk and a father that came out of the stands to be with his son. And this is what God has done for us in Jesus. The incarnation tells us that God is with us, Emmanuel. And he comes to you and says, I want you to have a close encounter. Jesus at one point said it this way in John chapter 6. He says, I am the bread of life. Whoever comes to me will never go hungry, and whoever believes in me will never be thirsty. And so he invites you to come, to eat and to drink, and to experience a close encounter with him this morning. Amen? All right, would you pray with me? Father, thanks so much for your love. You are a great and mighty God. And thanks for the journey that you have invited us into. It doesn't make sense all the time, but we know that you're faithful and you're true. And God, thank you for showing up in the darkest of times, and thank you for being with us in the best times as well, and all the way in between. Lord, we love you, and this morning we come to you in Jesus' name. Amen.